You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI.
Kansas City Community Radio.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Everything about it is appealing, everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are alone. Yesterday they told you you would not go far. That night you open and there you are. Next day on your dressing room they scenery, the makeup, the props, the audience that lifts you when you're down. The headaches, the heartaches, the backaches, the flops, the sheriff who escorts you out of town. The opening when your heart beats like a drum. The closing when the customers don't come. Word before the show has started that your favorite uncle died at dawn. On top of that, your partner has parted. You're brokenhearted, but you go on. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. Even with a turkey that you know will fold, you may be stranded out in the cold. Still, you wouldn't change it for a sack of gold.
Welcome to this edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. Glad to have you with us on this Monday. Boy, do we have some interesting things to send your way today. Interesting stories, interesting background, as we often do here on the Arts Magazine Show, right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. Great. Some great goings on here on the show today. We're going to talk with folks from Spinning Tree Theater. They are doing West Side Story over at the Arts Asylum. That's over at 9th and Harrison. And here to talk about the great battle between the Sharks and the Jets. Kind of a takeoff on Romeo and Juliet, if you didn't know that. Our two of my guests, Andy Parkhurst, is with us. He is one of the founders of Spinning Tree Theater. He is also the co-director of the show. He was part of the European tour back in 1997. And that's where he met his partner, Michael Grayman, as well. And they are doing this show. They're co-directing and recreating some of Jerome Robbins' original choreography. Also with us, playing the role of Maria, is Megan Herrera. She is with us as well. She is one of the sharks in the show. Yeah, and it really is a takeoff on Romeo and Juliet, sort of in an urban setting. But Andy, I want to hear how this all originated for you. You and Michael were part of the European tour of this show. That's where you met and first did this show.
That's right. Michael and I met in Milan, Italy in 1998. He was just off of the 40th anniversary Broadway tour of West Side Story that was supervised by its creator, Jerome Robbins, and the book writer, the librettist Arthur Lawrence. Michael joined the European tour, and we became close friends. The European tour, as well as the Broadway tour, were set by Alan Johnson, who is well known for choreographing choreographing all of the Mel Brooks musicals, but he also was in the original cast of West Side Story. So we are delighted to be recreating the Robbins choreography on an all-local professional cast here in Kansas City.
Michael worked with Robbins.
He did. Jerome Robbins and Arthur Lawrence both frequented the tour that Michael was on, and he learned a lot from them and has some interesting stories that maybe he could tell you at the bar after a performance.
Probably more than willing to do so. So this makes this more than just you're doing West Side Story. It's more of a personal thing for both of you.
Absolutely. It's the show that we met on. It's one of our favorite shows between us. In addition to those productions, we have 9 professional productions of West Side Story under our belt, and we thought the time was right to produce it while opening Spinning Tree Theater's 5th season.
Yeah, 5th season, and time goes so fast, doesn't it?
It does. It's hard to believe.
The show is going on at the Arts Asylum, 1000 9th Street, essentially the intersection of 9th and Harrison, on the east side of downtown.
That's right.
That's where you're doing this show. Tell the folks just a little bit about the founding of Spinning Tree Theater.
Sure.
It's an interesting story.
Well, Michael and I moved back to Kansas City, which is my hometown, 5 years ago. To start Spinning Tree Theater, our dream was to found a small professional theater company, and we are a theater company that, like some of the others in town, like Kansas City Actors Theater, we use a variety of venues around Kansas City. So we produce plays and musicals. We do currently 4 shows a year. Our season membership has just skyrocketed from 2 years ago when we first started to offer it, and this is also our first season as a fully as an equity house, which means
we are
no longer on the special appearance agreement through Actors Equity, but we're on a small professional theater contract with them, which is great.
It goes by the size of theater, and not that the theater over there is small. It's really not. You can see quite a few people over there.
Yeah, we've got it hooked up for about 170. It's a great space, our first time at the Arts Asylum, but we're really enjoying it, and we're looking forward to having the people start to come Thursday night.
That's right. It's very soon now, Thursday, August 20th, 7:30 p.m., essentially 3 weekends. Well, not more than just the weekend, but Thursday the 20th and Friday the 21st. The Thursday shows are at 7:30. The Friday shows at 8. The Saturday shows are at 8. The matinees are in the afternoon at 2 o'clock p.m., and this is pretty much the pattern. The second week starts Wednesday, so Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday afternoon matinee. Then the third weekend, we're into September now, Wednesday the 2nd, Thursday the 3rd, Friday the 4th, Saturday's the 5th, and 2 performances on Saturday the 5th. I already said Saturday the 5th, 2 o'clock p.m. and 8 o'clock p.m. at the Arts Asylum. As I said, located at 1000 9th Street, essentially the corner of 9th and Harrison on the east side. You're just on the east side of the freeway as it comes down, right?
That's right.
And the show, of course, is West Side Story. Maria Herrera is with Megan Herrera, who plays the role of Maria.
At this point, I respond to Maria.
That's right.
Well, that's good to know, Maria. Is part of an all-local cast. What's that like? Had you done this show at any point in your life before?
You know, it's kind of the show that made me want to be an actor, in all honesty.
My.
I got to do it in high school, not playing Maria, playing Anita, because my brother was Tony, so that would have been awkward on many levels. But it is a show that it relates to everybody, so to get to dig my teeth into it at 16 is pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. And since then, going through college and learning a little bit more about my type, I decided that Maria was hands down not only my favorite musical from when I used to watch it as a little kid, but Maria would be a dream role. So it's pretty incredible to get to see it over the last couple weeks, because we've only been rehearsing for a couple weeks at this point. To see it grow with the local cast, I mean, day one, you're blown away by the talent. And as we've said, we are doing the original Jerome Robbins choreography, and to kind of see the people, many I've worked with before and many I've never met, that are all here in Kansas City just nailing it, it's pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm. You have to be pretty multifaceted for this one. There's there's dancing. Well, acting, of course. Dancing. Singing, fight choreography as well.
That's
a lot of that in the show. Was this a difficult one for you?
For me, yeah, absolutely. But that's part of what makes it fun. I think you want roles that are difficult and that are challenging, because that's what makes you grow as an artist. And it's also just the most rewarding. It's so very, very exciting to get to have this journey, because Maria specifically goes from such an innocent point and then has to deal with all the racial strife and all the tension around her, and then meeting her soulmate, if you will, and then just kind of how it crumbles, which really is the quintessential love story with Romeo and Juliet. Mm-hmm. So it is challenging, but that's why I love it.
Yes, Andy. As I said earlier, it's patterned at least after Romeo and Juliet, opposing gangs, as it were, the sharks and the jets. Yeah, you've heard the saying, once you're a jet, you're always a jet.
Right. When you're a jet, you're a jet.
That's right.
And it really was the first musical that really demanded the performers be triple threats. You know, before that, even was starting with Oklahoma with the Dream Ballet, dance had already been woven into musicals as a plot-furthering device. But with this show, the dancers were expected to sing and to act. The singers were expected to at least move well and to act. And the actors are expected to do all three as well. So with, as you said, fight choreography on top of all of it. So it really is an incredibly difficult show to cast, and a very difficult and demanding show to perform.
I'll bet. And also to direct.
Absolutely.
I assume you're doing the choreography on your own.
Michael Grayman and I have recreated it. That's right.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You also have the music. Do you have a musical director?
Of course, yes. Gary Green. It's our first time to work with Gary. He just moved back to Kansas City. He's from here as well. He moved back from New York, where he had a successful career on Broadway, as well as teaching at a William and Mary College. He's just fantastic and has, I think, helped everyone kind of find their best, which is what Michael and I are about, you know, pushing them to the point of them really learning and developing and growing, not only in the role, but probably beyond that for their career. He's a fantastic musical director.
Sure. Well, let's hear about some of the songs. For instance, Megan, what do you sing?
I sing a whole bunch of stuff. I get to sing Tonight, of course, which so many people sing, but it's first introduced in the balcony scene with Tony and Maria when they, when Tony's just so enamored that he finds himself in her neighborhood, and so they sing Tonight together. And then that's reintroduced several times throughout the musical, including the one of my favorite numbers, the quintet, which I always mistake for the finale of Act One, but then you have the rumble right after it. But that's just a truly, no matter when I hear it, kind of goosebump sort of number. And then I get to do I Feel Pretty, Boy Like That, I Have a Love, which that is hands down my favorite. And then towards the end, we sing Somewhere a cappella.
That's right. A cappella is always a challenge.
It is, but when you're given such great material acting-wise, it comes for you. It almost doesn't feel like a song at that point.
It's a show that works, and that's a real spinning tree thing, too, to choose material, because Michael and I, in our careers before we started Spinning Tree, worked on our share of shows as actors, as directors, choreographer, where you're sitting at a table for weeks before rehearsal starting, you know, tearing your hair out, going, how are we going to make this work? Whether it be a moment in the show or the entire show. And West Side Story is just another one of those shows we're producing that you don't have to worry about making it work. It all works beautifully. And as long as you cast it correctly, which we have for certain, it just comes to life beautifully.
And what about some of the other songs that Megan didn't mention?
Yeah, there's America.
Yeah, America, yeah. Officer Krupke. Those are kind of iconic ones, if you will. I know I'm kind of dancing in the wings, wishing I was in America. One of the best ones. And then Cool Boy and the Jet Song. And then Tony's got gorgeous numbers in Act One. We have Something's Coming and Maria.
It's just hit after hit. Yeah, Cool is, you know, of course, in Act One, the big number where Riff is trying to get the jets to chill out a little bit before this big war council with the sharks. And Michael and I believe that it is probably the hardest dance in Broadway musical theater repertoire. Our cast is doing an incredible job with it. But it's actually structured, Jerome Robbins structured it so that it's practically impossible to do it perfectly, which adds to the aggression that the jets feel and the tension. And, you know, we told the group day one when we started to work on the number, we said, you know, the best dancers we worked with who would come to the companies that we worked with from New York City Ballet, other top ballet companies, would come off stage just swearing every night after that number because they just couldn't nail it. So his choreography is a thrill to work on. Every moment, every movement is motivated. There's no movement for movement's sake. It's all telling a story, which makes it, I think, so satisfying to do and much more satisfying to watch than a lot of, you know, kind of present day choreography.
So I compared it earlier to Romeo and Juliet, but it is a story in and of itself in an urban setting. Which one of you would like to tackle the storyline for West Side Story?
Yeah, absolutely. It starts out with, the prologue is really just an amazing piece at the beginning of this, where you get to see the two opposing gangs, the Sharks and the Jets, which would be the Puerto Ricans that are starting to move into the west side of Manhattan. And then we have the Jets, which are the gang that's been there, although if we think about it, they probably have only been there a decade, if you will, because their families are probably immigrants as well. Mm-hmm. And it really is, a lot of it is the struggle between those two gangs fighting over their turf. And we're introduced to some of the adult characters that are few but very important, Lieutenant Trank and Officer Krupke, as well as Doc. And we kind of see how they're into the storyline as well, and you see a lot of the racism stemming from them. And then we have them decide, you know, we're going to go to this dance, and there's going to be, we got to get our land, we got to be Jets. When you're a Jet, you're on top of the world, and the Sharks are kind of in the way right now. And then something happens, and Tony and Maria see each other, and it's kind of, they're done after that point. It's this really beautiful moment, and one of my most favorite moments is when they do first see the choreography, the music, and just walking towards each other because the world disappears. And so then the storyline becomes, how does this undeniable love story work in this racially violent, hateful society we have? And at the end of the day, they're all kids. Mm-hmm. So you get to see how those extreme emotions work with kids and manifest, and how it, I won't give it away, but many people know it. But kind of how their love story evolves and the tragedies that are surrounded, and how they just want to get away because loving is enough.
Yeah, forbidden love is always attractive on a certain
mm-hmm.
level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want what we can't have.
That's right. That's right.
It's very interesting. We're speaking with Andy Parkhurst, who is the co-director of helping doing the choreography, one of the founders, along with Michael Grayman, of the Spinning Tree Theater Troupe. Performed this show together on a European tour back in the late 90s. Was it 97?
Yeah, Michael did the Broadway 40th anniversary tour in 97, and then he joined me on the European 40th anniversary tour in 98. And essentially what we did with that tour was we played large European cities for about a month at a time. So it didn't feel like a tour. It felt like paid vacation doing the greatest show ever made.
Did the people in Europe understand the racial divides of the United States?
Oh, absolutely. It was a German company. And I did another production of the show in Augsburg, Germany, which was an interesting production because it was done in German, but the songs were in English, which made for some interesting internal dialogue bumps. The director was American. He brought about 10 American actors over, and there were people from 10 countries in the show. And we did it at an amphitheater in Augsburg, which was the site of Nazi youth rallies formerly.
Oh, wow.
And so that just kind of brought a whole other thing to it. But the people, you know, they definitely look at it as we do, as both entertainment and as a sort of an enormous teaching tool. And I think a lot of what we've discovered in working on the show these past weeks is that the show is just as relevant and topical. And certainly that's part of what makes it a classic. Yeah. In addition to being written so expertly. But the themes that we're talking about, discrimination, racism, right now there's a real sort of hatred of immigrants in the United States. These are all things that are just as topical now as they were when the show was first made.
Certainly. Well, being an equity house, that gives you the opportunity to use more professionals in the show. But you have an all-local cast. I guess I'm thinking of Kip Niven. I know Kip is in your cast.
Kip is in it, yep.
An actual Broadway song and dance man.
That's right. The one and only Kip Niven. Vanessa Severo plays Anita. She's fantastic. Of course, Jacob Aaron Collum is Tony. And we have a wonderful cast of 30 people that are singing and dancing and acting and fighting. It's just an absolute thrill to be in the room with this much talent.
Yeah, the fight choreography must take time, must be meticulous.
It does. It does. It's dangerous. So there is plenty of rehearsal involved in that. And that's an important part of the show. And this production, we've made it a little bit less dancey than the original might have felt and a little bit grittier so that it feels a little bit more real.
Now, Megan, did you get in on the fight? In the age of equality, do the ladies get involved in some of the fights?
You know, not so much. I think I have my own personal little fight with Tony, for sure. I get to have my little moment. And then, of course, the gut-wrenching end of the show.
Well, don't give that away.
Right.
But I do get some grit. I don't lose. I don't just sit and smile and feel pretty and witty and gay. I definitely feel things and get to have my own moments. But no, I don't get to in on any of the fun fighting, if you
will.
But
the character of Anybody's, which is the female, Daria LeGrand plays her. She's the tomboy that really wants to be a jet and just annoys the heck out of all the guys. She does get in on the fighting. So Daria gets to beat some guys up on stage.
Well, yeah. Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim,
mm-hmm.
You got some hard you got some hard shoes to fill there.
It was a tight group. I mean, looking back on it, it was Stephen Sondheim's first Broadway show. He was the lyricist, but he was in pretty good company with Leonard Bernstein and Jerome Robbins and Arthur Lawrence on the book. I mean, it's a tight collaboration. And it just, you know, as we said, it just plays beautifully today. It's a classic musical, and in that it feels like it could have been written yesterday.
Oh, it's a great
There's
idea.
There's nothing dated about it.
If you think about it, it was a great idea. You took the situation in Romeo and Juliet, changed it to pattern the urban situation going on in New York City at the time, very ethnically diverse in those areas, and make that into a musical.
Right, right. And it's a dark musical.
Yeah.
It's a musical tragedy, really. There's plenty of comic moments in it. There's a lot of humor. There's a lot of festive dancing, but at the end of the day, it's a pretty tragic story.
And you got a long 3-week run at the Arts Asylum, located at 1000 East 9th Street, essentially the corner of 9th and Harrison. It's just on the east side of downtown, where Harrison goes up. So they probably need to go down to, I'm going to guess, Truman Road.
And then you can take 71 Highway and take the Admiral Boulevard exit. It's right there.
Okay.
Yep, and the directions are on our website, spinningtreetheater.com.
From the basics here, the number I have to call, Andy, is 816-569-5277.
Mm-hmm.
And the website you can go to for more information is spinningtreetheater.com. Can they make arrangements for tickets online as well?
Absolutely, but it's selling out. The opening night is sold out and has been for about a week and a half. The other performances are selling out as well. Seating is limited. It is an intimate environment, which is what we enjoy doing at Spinning Tree Theater. So every row, there's not more than 6 rows away from the action. So people should hurry up and get their tickets right now.
Exciting shows that you do down there. You do a lot of musicals. You've done some non-musicals.
Mm-hmm.
But
we
do
half
a lot
and
of
half.
Musicals too.
Yeah, we do about half and half. Our season is 2 musicals and 2 plays.
Yeah. Well, do you want to talk about the rest of your season? This kicks off your season.
Yeah, this is our 5th season, West Side Story opening it, and we depart greatly from that for the next one in the fall is a 2-person play based on Henry James' gothic thriller, The Turn of the Screw.
Oh.
And that stars Charles Fugate and Nicole Murray Green. And then we're doing Jason Robert Brown's rock musical 13, which is comprised of 13 teenagers. We're really excited to showcase 13 of Kansas City's brightest stars to be singing and dancing and acting. And it's sort of an edgy PG-13 rated depiction of what it's like to be a teenager. And then we'll end the season in April and May with Amadeus. And we have some exciting plans with that. Walter Coppedge and Robert Gibby Brand are starring in that.
Well, they're both very good.
No slouches.
No. I said it to him the last time he was on. You know, nobody speaks badly about Walter Coffin.
That's really true. That's really true. Yeah, he's a great guy. A great actor.
He is a great guy. Mm-hmm. And Robert Kibbe Brand, as well as being a fantastic actor, mm-hmm. is also, I've seen him sing opera.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's got a command of all those languages. That will come in very handy.
He does have a command. And some of the best knowledge, I wanted to say trivia, but...
Oh, he's a smart guy. Yeah, he really is.
You ask him about some of the authors.
Absolutely.
He knows in great detail Absolutely. All about them. And you'll find that's true probably about Mozart, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Probably knows all the intrigue
right.
about Mozart. There was a lot of intrigue.
That's right.
Surrounding Mozart, his life, and his death. Frankly, mm-hmm. All with that.
We'll have to come back and talk about it.
That's right. I'm sure we will. What goes into picking your season? Do you intentionally pick a couple of musicals?
Yeah, we are at the moment. We're doing four shows a season, and it's two plays and two musicals. And really, we have just a list of our favorite plays and musicals. And that is the biggest criteria. And then we look at what we think we could cast well in Kansas City. And it just needs to be shows that we want to spend months working on and devouring and making our, 18-hour days lives full of. So that, these shows all fit that criteria. And I think, especially for a young theater company, that's the best thing we can do is do shows we love. And the actors feel that, and the designers and the audiences, most importantly, feel that.
I guess you have no reticence about the talent pool here.
Not at all. No, there's tons of actors we haven't even had an opportunity to work with yet that we look forward to. West Side's been fun because it's so many younger performers. And to do a dance musical for the first time, we were sort of reticent about that. And then we just went, hey, we just need to do it. I think this is the right time to do it. But people are going to be thrilled at the level of excellent dancing going on in the show. Mm-hmm. And no one's from out of town. We typically have that people will come up to us at the end of a show and go, that was an amazing cast. Where are they from? Are they from New York? Are they from Chicago? So I look forward to telling people beginning Thursday night, no, they're all from Kansas City.
Were you concerned at first that you're finding enough good, talented Latino actors that could sing and dance?
No, and we've sort of moved beyond that because there's more colorblind casting now. So they don't need to be, just as when you do, Amadeus, the actor, Walter Coppedge is playing Salieri.
Uh-huh.
So you don't need to be as concerned with that anymore. It's more about finding the right actor for the right role and making sure that it's a good fit. Some of that is important, but it's not as much as it used to be. It's more about being more colorblind and looking at the talent.
I'm sure. Well, you've come a long ways already. Where would you like to see Spitting Tree go in the future? I'm sure you have conversations about this.
Oh, when we have a chance, we sure do. not the last few weeks, but we are starting to look for our own space or a shared space with another arts organization, and that's very thrilling, and it's quite a process. We've been talking about that for a while, but that is more and more a priority for us so that we can enlarge our season, so that we can begin an education department. We have many thoughts. Some of them I won't share because I don't want to give other people our great ideas. But we're just, keeping on keeping on. And I think the thing with Michael and I is that we challenge the people that work for us and with us greatly, but we challenge ourselves and each other more than we challenge anybody. So it's sort of like, if somebody's not up for that, then that's not going to be the right fit. But for us, we're like, okay, we're doing West Side. It's going really well. What haven't we done? What's as scary as hell? What is the hardest thing that we could do? And let's do it.
Oh.
And that's a lot of what drives us is the repertoire is eclectic, but it's stuff that we love, and it's turning over every stone. And it's our patron base and our season members and even the people that write about the company are really understanding that. The top regional theaters in the country don't have to be niche theaters. It doesn't have to be this theater company or that theater company. It's doing high-quality productions, and that's what we're striving for.
Sure. Well, West Side Story opens this Thursday, the 20th of August at 7:30 p.m. Performances continue then Friday the 21st at 8, Saturday the 22nd at 8, Sunday the 23rd at 2 o'clock p.m. A little different the second week. It's Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, again, Sunday afternoon. Then the third week, September the 2nd, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday. Is it just a matinee on Saturday?
Yes, we have one Saturday matinee on September 5th.
Then also at 8 o'clock p.m. on Saturday the 5th as well. And don't make the mistake of thinking you can see a Sunday afternoon performance on the next day, because I don't believe you have one.
That's right. We'll be loading out.
And that's happening at the Arts Asylum, 1000 East 9th Street, essentially the corner of 9th and Harrison. You'll get to hear the music of Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim, as well as the fine cast put together by Andy Parkhurst and Michael Grayman. West Side Story. I think it's a fascinating story, and I learned about it by reading Alan Portner's article on AXS.com, and learned all about their history, which makes for an even more fascinating story for you, Andy, of West Side Story opening on the 20th at the Arts Asylum. Once again, the number to call is 816-569-5277 or on the web at SpinningTreeTheater.com. Thanks so much for being with us, Andy, as well as Megan Herrera, who plays the role of Maria. West Side Story.
Thanks,
opening
Michael.
Up this
Thank
Thursday.
You.
Thank you very much for being here. When we return, we'll have much more to tell you about an author of a new book. It's about Bigfoot, or at least Momo, the Missouri Monster. But more on that when we return. You're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. Ice Cube said, quote, "Our art is a reflection of our reality," unquote. And that harsh reality is ably reflected in the compelling, no-holds-barred drama Straight Outta Compton, the story of the rise of the controversial West Coast rap group N.W.A. The movie showcases the group's strong social commentary as well as the members' bohemian activities and personal conflicts. While gritty and realistic, it's also surprisingly funny. A strong cast of lookalikes for Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, Eazy-E, MC Ren, and DJ Yella breathe life into director F. Gary Gray's intriguing biopic. Even though the movie loses a lot of dramatic steam in the second half, Straight Outta Compton provides an interesting background for the uninitiated and an entertaining nostalgia trip for fans. Who would have thought that the old TV series from the 1960s, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., would have been contemporary movie fodder? Henry Cavill plays U.S. secret agent Napoleon Solo and Army Hammer's Russian agent Ilya Kuryakin, who team up to take on an international crime organization. Director Guy Ritchie's tongue-in-cheek thriller is a mildly entertaining throwback full of zippy action and good humor. The filmmakers chose to maintain the 60s Cold War setting, and that decision turned out to be a good one. It doesn't amount to much, but the stars exhibit some easy charm, and the slick execution makes The Man from U.N.C.L.E. a breezy late-summer distraction. Also opening this week, The End of the Tour is a film about a series of interviews between Rolling Stone reporter David Lipsky and the acclaimed author David Foster Wallace. Jesse Eisenberg and Jason Segel star. Best of Enemies is a documentary about the feud between 1960s voices of the left and right, William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal. Cop Car is a crime thriller starring Kevin Bacon. And Rosamund Pike stars as an assault victim who seeks revenge in the drama Return to Sender. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI FM. Freeze Frame!
This week, when civil law requires parents to vaccinate their children, should they be able to seek exemptions for religious reasons?
I don't think it is your right to put your child in harm's way. If you choose to put your child in harm's way, that's not a religious act.
I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices. Tuesday at noon, right before The Jazz Disciple.
The Hungry March Band are a blazing parade of flesh, blood, steel, brass, and wood. Hear all about them and their portable soundtracks for temporary utopias on Sprouts, Thursday at noon.
90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio invites you to White Noise Embracing the Spirit, Sunday, September 13th from 1:30 to 6 p.m. at Belvoir Winery in Liberty, Missouri. This one-day retreat is for writers and poets, painters and photographers, and curious others to explore, write, and create on the grounds of one of the most haunted locations in the Midwest. For more information, call 816-931-8858 or visit kkfi.org. This is Maria Vasquez Boyd, host and producer of ArtSpeak Radio, inviting you to tune in to ArtSpeak Radio at our new time, Wednesday at noon to 1 p.m. That's right, from noon to 1 p.m. on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And welcome back to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Don't do book authors too often. There's too many theatrical activities going on. But this author is really something. You know, he has come out with a new book, and it might be made into a movie in the future. It's on a very interesting subject. If you listen to any of the very late night programs, well, I'll just say George Norrie, he will sometimes feature the subject of cryptozoology. And yes, that means Bigfoot. Whether you believe or not, that's the subject. And here to tell us all about his new book, Momo, is author Kevin M. Kraft. He is a novelist, of course, multi-award winning screenwriter, CEO of his own company, TEK Productions, and his book, Momo, and he's also been an assistant director, actor, writer. He's on Facebook. Hey, you've got it all covered, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael, for having me on.
Yeah, Bigfoot. People either smile or they frown when they hear that name.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
What's your take on Bigfoot? Do you think he's really out there?
I do. I think that there's, to say that the hundreds, if not thousands, of reports that have been filed and those that we, you know, things that we haven't even heard, haven't been reported, that all the reports, that all the evidence, all the eyewitness accounts, even accounts that would to us be prehistory, to say that all those things are wrong is just, to me, it's unreasonable to say that. I think there is something there. Do I believe that every sighting of Bigfoot is Bigfoot? No, of course not. I think a good majority of them are probably misidentifications. But you got a lot of people saying that they've seen something like Bigfoot or any of his cousins that have nothing to gain by coming out and saying they did. As a matter of fact, many of them have waited years after their sighting to report it, and that's only after some other people have reported similar things, you know? So I think that it just defies logic to say that there's nothing to it at all.
Well, they seem to follow, or fall, I should say, in two categories. It's either man-made in some way through, I guess, would the term be cryptozoology?
Yes. Yes.
Or it's an alien from space come down. It seems to fall in one of those two categories.
That's true.
And you'll hear people on shows, on documentaries. You'll occasionally see something on the History Channel. History 2 especially will cover activities like this. Do you fall in either one of those categories?
I think that it is simply an animal that hasn't been categorized or identified or recognized by science yet. If I were to tell you that in Asia, you know, that there was a hairy man-like beast that roamed the mountains of Asia, you know, you might think, oh, that just sounds weird. This sounds ridiculous. But I've just described the great mountain gorilla, which was, until it was finally proven and they had a specimen and everything, was thought to be a myth in that region. It could be the same thing with Bigfoot. You know, maybe there is in the case of particularly a Bigfoot, there could be a great American ape that is yet to be recognized and classified, you know, by science, which is the only way they're going to recognize it, is if they actually find one and have one that they can study. Everything is a monster until it's in a zoo, I say, you know, until science recognizes it. And here's the thing, too, is that Bigfoot, you know, Bigfoot is the name given to the creature that is uniquely American or Canadian. There are creatures like Bigfoot seen virtually all over the world. Different incarnations of that. You know, all over the world. And so that to me also gives it more credence. You know, it's like there's something out there. There's something out there that we just haven't classified yet.
Kind of this Native American legends.
Mm-hmm,
there's
exactly.
Legends of other, you know, ethnicities. They have legends about it.
Exactly.
It does sort of sound like the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, it really does. Well, you took your interest in this, and you have created a book. I guess a book that you hope to write a screenplay about and turn into a film.
Well, actually, it's the other way around. The screenplay was already written. I had written the screenplay Momo several years ago when we founded TEK Productions, my wife and I. When we thought, well, what could we do? We had some projects already. We had some screenplays already that we wanted to develop. But I decided we needed to do something small, something low budget, something that could be easily made. And so I thought, well, what might that interest? What might I want to film? And I remembered from childhood a lot of my things that I write now. I thought of in childhood, and they've just fermented and everything throughout years, and I write them as an adult. Well, I had this idea of like a Bigfoot type creature as at the center of a film, and I was influenced by thrillers like The Thing from Another World, you know, the old 1954 movie with James Arness, and that to me was one of the best thrillers ever made, and I've always wanted to duplicate that kind of thrill in a project. But I was also very interested in cryptozoology, particularly the hairy hominids like Bigfoot and so when I was a kid. So I came up with this germ of an idea when I was a kid, and then later on as we considered projects, I decided on the Bigfoot type character. But I didn't know until I started researching for the script that Missouri had its own Bigfoot, basically. And that was Momo, short from his Missouri Monster. And I was kind of upset with myself because I'd been involved with cryptozoology since I was 10 years old. And I thought, how have I not heard of this before, And so I read about this phenomenon. It's a 2-week phenomenon back in 1972. For 2 weeks, the small town of Louisiana, Missouri was terrorized by this creature. And what makes the story so remarkable to me was that there were so many reports in this small area, and there was a rash of reports, and then it stopped all of a sudden. And it's like, and it's still, the people still talk about it today, although probably in the town of Louisiana, I don't know if they talk about it a lot, but it became a legend, So I started researching this, and I thought, perfect, because I live in Missouri. I want this to be a Kansas City, Missouri, project if it ever gets made into a movie. So I thought, it's perfect. So I wrote Momo and put it at its center, father and son, on a camping trip trying to survive against this thing. And I actually had my son and I in mind to play the roles, because I'm a guerrilla filmmaker. I thought, hey, we could do that, And so I wrote the script and refined it, and, my family loved it. My son and I started looking at it together, and he's a great little actor. He's not little anymore, but at the time he was. And I thought, maybe we could do this. So we tried to look for funding for it and everything, and that didn't happen. I think we tried on two occasions to try to find funding for it, and it just didn't go anywhere. It's probably, I blame myself for that. I'm not much of a salesman, probably, but my wife encouraged me a couple of years ago. She said, because we still believe in a project, we said, well, why don't you write the novel, get that out there, and then maybe it'll generate interest in the movie. And I resisted that for the first year, and then she said it again last year, and I thought, I've never adapted one of my scripts into a novel. I wasn't confident that I could do it. But I said, I'll give it a try. And I did. I adapted it into a short novel. And I thought, let me see how it plays with everybody. And I gave it to my beta readers. I have beta readers that read my novels before they're released and everything. And the response was overwhelming. With what they is about the same response I got with the script, because I sent the script out for people in the movie business, and everybody loved the story, loved the script and everything. I mean, it's just a real emotional response. And I thought, wow, I did exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to write an effective thriller, and the book got the same response. Everybody was overwhelming with their response. I mean, some people, would come to me with tears in their eyes and say, I love the story of the father and the son. It reminded me of my relationship with my own dad and stuff. I'm like, whoa, I didn't expect all that, but the response was overwhelming. And so I released Momo on Lulu, self-published it. And, you know, people are still buying it, you know, and people are still talking about it. I do interviews like this, you know, more and more, and building my readership and everything. I'm almost my fourth book. It's my fourth book that I've self-published. And it's probably my shortest book that I've written so far, but it's gotten one of the biggest responses out of all the stuff I've written so far, you know. So it's been really rewarding to see people's response to that. And like I said, getting the movie done is my end goal, my end game to all this.
Sure, it does sound like you have a great story. We're speaking with author Kevin Kraft, novelist, a screenwriter. He's been an actor himself as well as an assistant director and other things, talking about his new book, Momo, and screenplay Momo. Yeah, and Momo is short for Missouri Monsters, Kansas City, Missouri's own version of Bigfoot. And the book is out there. Tell the folks about the self-publishing angle of things, how they can get your book, and how you self-publish. You bypass the big publishers, and people publish themselves. I guess it all has to do with online, social media, mm-hmm. all of that. Explain to the folks something of how that is done.
Sure. First off, I have to say I'm really upset at myself, because back in the 90s, as far back as the 90s, I had the idea of self-publishing, because as a writer, I would send out work, you know, to different publishers, and it's unless you're like the flavor of the month, they won't really take a look a second look at it. They want to publish things that are already successful. Okay. And so I was frustrated with that, and I said, gosh, wouldn't it be nice to be able to have the technology to just, you know, publish good quality books on demand. In other words, you don't have a big overhead or a warehouse full of stacks of books. As people order these things, they would print the books accordingly. And I had this whole idea about digital technology and how it might work, but of course I didn't have the money to do it. Well, here we are, 2015,
oh, yeah.
And print on demand is taken off, you know, greatly. There are at least four major companies that do it, including Lulu. I think Lulu's probably the best known. And so I'm kicking myself like, oh, why couldn't I have started this? It's all set up for life, you know. But the self-publishing thing is, it's great, especially for the do-it-yourselfer like me. I'm a real, you know, self-sufficient, do-it-yourself kind of guy. And so it offers the best in do-it-yourself, you know, the method of doing things yourself. It's digital technology. It's very easy to do. First thing you got to do is have a book, a manuscript, you know. It's got to be a good book. I mean, you can publish a bad book, but you want a good one, you know, because one of the things about self-publishing that gets a bad rap is that authors release bad books, mm-hmm. self-published. And so it has a bad rap already in the industry, because it's like, you know, if it's self-published, it means not any good. Well, I think a lot of people are like, almost with digital technology where music is concerned, people are tired of going through somebody else to get their work out. You know, and they say, well, let's do it ourselves. You know, we'll self-publish it. And it's very easy to do. If you have a manuscript, you go to any of these sites. Lulu, Create Space is another one. There are a few of them. And you make sure your novel is formatted the way it needs to be. They have their guidelines. You upload it to their site after it's edited. So that's your text. You create your cover as a digital JPEG, upload that, and make sure all your other information is in there that you need, and publish it. And it's online. People can order the book through the publisher, and most of these places also have ties to like Amazon and Kindle and Nook and everything like that. So they have all these other, you know, marketplaces, these outlets where people can buy your book, and that's how you self-publish, basically. It's very, very easy to do. The technology available today is astounding. You need to have a good quality book. Instead of something just on typing paper or something with spiral bindings that you might see back in the 80s and 90s, and now they're almost virtually indistinguishable from mm-hmm. a book from a traditional, you know, publisher, and that's how you do it. So that's the first part of the game. Now you got to do self promotion.
True, and they have to know what they're going for to find it.
That would be the hardest thing. Yeah. Exactly, and that is the hardest thing. Traditional publishers have a big promotional, you know, department at their disposal, and so they can handle a lot of that for you. But even so, the author has to do a lot himself. And self-publishing, you do all the footwork. You do all the promotion and the self-promotion and everything, which can take hours, you know, of a day. But if you're diligent, and I wasn't for a long time. It wasn't until Momo, as a matter of fact, that I really got serious about branding as branding myself as an author, mm-hmm. and getting the word out, you know, and showing people where everything was. Up to that point, I was content with just having my book out, and I could, you know, refer people that I wanted to it and everything. Momo kind of upped my game, and so you know, getting on social media, getting a website going, and everything, and it paid off. You know, I'm like, wow, this, you know, it really works when you actually apply, you know, good marketing principles and stuff. And I was really pleased to see, you know, people actually go out and buy my book. I read the reviews on book blogs and on Amazon and on Goodreads and everything. And it's just been really wonderful to see almost unanimously uh-huh. wonderful reviews of the story and how people really connected to it, you know, and it's been very gratifying.
Must be very gratifying, and you didn't have to go through a big publishing house where they probably discard 90%
right.
of what they get,
yeah.
if not more than that.
Yeah, I control my own product, you
that's
know,
right.
and who can ask for better than that? I think that's wonderful.
Do you sell all of your books? You say you had four. Are all of them on available to be
yes.
purchased?
Yes, they are. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Is like a series? Do you do a series like some authors do, or does each story stand on its own?
Each story can stand on its own. The first two, my second and third book, I published one called S, Contemporary Religious Fantasy first, and then after that went so well, I published two of my earlier novels that were part of the series, the W3 Crew and the W3 Crew 2 Underground, and I got to write a third book actually to complete the trilogy. So some of them are series. A book that's coming up is going to be part one of a series. Momo is a standalone book, so. There we go.
The next thing the folks want to know, how do they get to the place where they can take a preview look, perhaps, at some of what you've written, and sure. then perhaps, if they choose, buy, and how would that work for
absolutely.
Them?
Absolutely. They can find a lot of all the information at my website. It is kevinmcraft.weebly.com. And all of the information about me is there, including links to the Lulu site where I publish my books. And Lulu is where you can read samples of my work. On the website, you can find out about the work themselves. You can read some reviews. I've got links to reviews and to Amazon and Goodreads and book blogs and everything. So there's plenty of information there. They can find everything they need to.
Sure. Now, the movie part of it, I guess, well, what do you do? Did you go out and raise money? How do you do that?
Well, I like the idea of crowdfunding. You know, I've tried sending the script to other professionals in the business, and like the book thing, you know, you really have to have an in order to get to somebody that'll do something with it. And so I thought crowdfunding at first. And we had very limited success with that. I'm not sure. I think, like I said, I think it's just me. I think I'm just maybe a bad salesman mm-hmm. or something, or maybe people were just tired of hearing me talk about it. I'm not sure. But I know we have a great project for a motion picture. I have a real big heart for Kansas City filmmaking. We have a burgeoning community here and wonderful talent. You know, here I think that we could become another Austin. I really do. I think we had that, but there's been kind of a cloud of indifference or apathy concerning the movie community here. And I would love to see Kansas City produce a project that gets not just national but international attention. You know, we just don't see that. We see a lot of them get, you know, the occasional short film award or some award for, you know, experimental, something like that. But I'd like to see something really big come out of Kansas City. I think we can do it, and I think I'm the one to do it, actually.
Okay.
But Momo, Momo is, it would be like a great film. Everybody has said so. I'm a screenwriter first. And so I'm a very visual writer, and everybody tells me I can see this happening. I can see this as a movie. I love what I can see when I read it, and that's what I want. I want people to be able to see it. And I think you know, since Momo started out as an award-winning screenplay, because it won the low budget screenplay award at the ZFest, low no budget screenplay award back 2010, and. And so, and it won some recognition from the Children's Media Institute. They have an organization called Kids First, and they look at things for children's media. And that was I wasn't sure if I would be recommended by that, because it is a scary movie. Scary movie idea, but they loved it. They said it's great. There are some great lessons in it. The relationship is great. Any of the violence in it, you know, isn't gratuitous, and it's a scary movie anyway, you know, so it's going to be that way. But they gave it a high recommendation, so I was proud of that, because I wanted to make a movie that a family could see, you know, at least most members of the family, maybe not the very youngest, but the, you know, certainly somebody 10 and up could see this and come away with it, not with just a thrill, but with, you know, something they could take home with them as far as the story and the relationship in the movie. You know?
Sure.
So I'd love to see Momo become a film. And so I'm hoping that somehow I'll find a way, maybe through the, you know, through the folks of Kansas City hearing this, you know, try to find a way to get this funded. I'm reluctant only because of going the crowdfunding route again, only because we've done it once before, and I don't want to do it again unless I can be sure we're going to get the support that we need to make
absolutely.
The film. And so if anybody has any ideas, if anybody's a millionaire out there wants to fund a film, you know, let me know. I know Momo would be a strong project, and it would be a successful project. I know that, you know. And so it's just a matter of getting it made.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely right. Well, once again, give your website, how people can get a message to you.
Sure. KevinMCraft.weebly.com. Craft is with a K. That's my main website. You can find me by name, Kevin Craft, on Facebook. And you can go to Lulu.com and look me up there as well by name.
The story of a father and son outing in the Ozarks near Highway 54,
yeah.
which runs through Missouri and several other states. And what they come up against there will boggle the mind.
That's right.
Thanks so much for being with us,
You're
Kevin.
You're welcome.
Kevin M. Craft, novelist, screenwriter, CEO of TEK Productions. His book, Momo, you can get it. Go through the links. Go to Kevin's website, kevinmcraft.weebly.com. And I guess if they follow the links, they can get to the Lulu site,
yes.
where they could perhaps preview
purchase your book.
Mm-hmm. And any other questions they have, they could probably leave you a message there.
Email me or call me or something. Yep.
Well, that's good. Well, thanks for coming in today, Kevin.
My pleasure.
Always interested to hear about new things going on, new books. Not too many people write about Bigfoot these days. Glad to see you're taking up in that market. You know, there's several UFO groups in the area that would probably love to hear from you as well.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
You might be
contact them,
as well. That's right. Thank you so much. Kevin Craft, book Momo, now available by going to his website. You can preview and read this as well as his previous works before that as well.
Absolutely.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you, Michael. Nice to have you on the show with me.
The Jazz Insider is next. He's going to play some great jazz for you this afternoon. We'll have jazz from 1 to 3. Then we'll have the blues from 3 to 6. KKFI is known for its jazz and its blues programming right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that crossing the road, I'm Michael Hogue. We'll see you next time.
Hour, you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. 88 degrees outside in Kansas City. Tonight, a low of 72. 88 is our high for the day. Cold front moving in with some rain. Tuesday, expect rainy most of the day. 78 for a high. 59. That's right. 59 for a low on Tuesday. Wednesday, 74 and 55. Thursday, a little warmer and sunshine. 83.
Friday 86, Saturday up to 90, and then it starts dropping back down again. Summer may be over. Stay tuned for Jazz Afternoon on KKFI.